You're with Nadia Mitsopoulos on ABC Radio Perth.
Welcome to Focus. Nice to have your company this morning. How closely do you watch your pennies these days? You start adding up your groceries on a calculator as you fill the trolley, stopping when you hit your limit, wondering what you have to put back. Do you really need the biscuits? The tin of Milo for the kids? Your children are at a state school, but the fees are still a hit. You get sick, but your GP doesn't bulk bill, so you push through. And despite watching your money, there's still not enough for this month's mortgage payment, and there wasn't enough for last month's either. And you've worked hard to buy your family home, and you are quite possibly now on the brink of losing it. Is this something you are going through? WA's Financial Counselling Network saw 3,200 homeowners in crisis in the past 6 months, and that's 40% more than the same time last year. And ABC News is rolling out a series of stories on mortgage stress over the next few days, and that is my focus this morning.
Focus Perth with Nadia Mitsopoulos on ABC Radio Perth.
And on the panel today, we have a financial counsellor, Siobhan Meerman, and also Paul Baird-Murray. He is a real estate agent in Baldivis. But before we get to the panel, I'd like you to meet Andrew and Rachel Hayden, who spent $600,000 on a house in Byford 3 years ago. They have three children, and they were both working until Rachel was diagnosed with a brain tumour 18 months ago. They have tried to sell their home at a loss, but no luck, and they are now waiting for a default notice from the bank. They were speaking to ABC's Alicia Kennedy.
But, yeah, honestly, we can't afford to keep the house, so, hopefully find a buyer. Otherwise, we'll just end up in the same hole again, and we would have used our super and, be no better off.
You do everything by the book. Everything. Just gutted for the kids, They don't do sports or anything. And haven't, because you just can't afford to. Sorry.
So, let's talk about this property here. When you listed it for sale 5 months ago.
Yep, we put it on. We first got told it was probably valued around like the
560.
Well, 560, yeah,
560.
Yeah, so we got told it was about 560. Mm. Yeah, then it was only a few months. Yeah, within 2 months, we sort of realised it wasn't going to sell for that, so we dropped it down to 480. And then, still haven't had no one come through, really.
And what do you owe on the property?
We owe $535.
So you'll be significantly behind even if you sell it?
Yep. Yeah, good.
Well, owed us more than that because on top we redrew and did an extra $50,000 worth of solar panels, aircon through the whole house, front and backyard, to make it livable, we just said it's going to be our dream home. You build it to good carpets in certain areas, and
yeah, so we put probably $600,000 into it. We're probably going to sell it for $480. Shocking.
I feel sorry for anyone going through this. No one should have to. There should be something there, something there to help, with something, because it ruins families. Why should anyone? It just ruins everything.
Long-term goal is hopefully sell the house, find a medical fix for Rachel, and then, we're going to live on a bus with our three kids and dodge the system, I suppose, that housing system. Because, I don't think we'd go back to it.
It took us so long to get here, and we thought, yes, no wasted rent money or anything like that, and both got good jobs, the kids are happy, and everyone's thriving, and, you peak and then it's just...
crumbles like that.
That was Andrew and Rachel Hayden, and it seems to be a familiar story. So why are more families experiencing mortgage stress? What is to blame? Let's ask our financial counsellor, Siobhan Meerman, and Paul Bed-Murray, a real estate agent in Baldivis. Welcome to both of you. Siobhan, is that a familiar story?
Yes, look, it's devastating and absolutely familiar. I'd say probably most of our clients have something similar when they come in to see us.
So what percentage of the clients that you see, and you work in the Midland area, what percentage of clients that you see are coming in because of mortgage stress?
Look, over the last 12 months or so, I'd say about 73 to 75%, and that has increased over the last couple of years.
How big an increase?
Look, up from 64%.
And who are these people? What are their circumstances?
Their ages do tend to be across the board, but we see a weighted increase in the 30 to 60 range. So people in their prime, people who often already have or had full-time work.
And have one house?
Look, they can have one house, they can have investment properties. For a while, their brokers were really spruiking the retirement planning of investment properties. And sadly, these people have sunk their retirement planning in good sense into it.
Okay. And when they come to you, where are they at? I mean, how dire are things for them? How close are they to potentially losing the home? Do they come to you when they've already started defaulting?
Yeah, look, almost always. Something we hear a lot is, I never knew that you existed. So people often don't know to come to us when it's still early. We also get people coming to us after there's already been a court judgment or when they're right on the brink of getting one.
And is there a new group of people emerging? I understand you're seeing people who are working, but obviously the income isn't matching the costs of a house.
Yeah, look, what happens is people lose their job through no fault of their own. They are trying hard, they get a new one, but the new one is not paying enough.
Paul, you work in Baldivis, and which in July was named as having the highest number of bankruptcies in Australia. What is the market like there?
The market's oversaturated with a large majority of properties on the market, around about 730 properties at the moment. And that's not uncommon for a new area to have such an amount of property available. But what we're finding is that a lot of people that bought in the boom and built in the boom, and while everything was going well and everyone had money, was all good and well. But when jobs changed and the mining sort of sector sort of slowed down a bit, obviously the stress started occurring.
Is that common in the fringe suburbs of Perth?
Look, I think the fringe suburbs of Perth attract obviously young couples, young families, where they can grow and build a nice house. I think one of the challenges we see is that the nice houses for a young couple, you know, might be just, you know, mum and dad and one child, a big four bedroom, two bathrooms with all the fruit. So maybe biting off a bit more than they can chew.
And what are the other? So this is common. You talk about those fringe suburbs. So east, you'd be looking at what, Armidale, Forestfield, Byford. Can you give us a bit of a snapshot of where you see this kind of thing happening?
Sure. The type of areas that this occurs quite often is the lower priced areas, and obviously in the fringes, further away from the CBD, the prices, you know, reduced down to a reasonable level. You know, it was only a couple of years ago Baldivis was looked upon as one of the hotspots, one of the most favourable places to buy and build. And I must admit, it is. It's a fantastic location. It's got the train station just up the road, it's got great shopping, it's got great schooling, it's only minutes away from the beach. It's a great spot and it would attract young couples. Unfortunately, I suppose a lot of times when they're building, they're not building a house to suit their financial budget. They're building a house to suit maybe the suburb or what they feel they should build. And, you know, four bedroom, two bathroom house, you know, for a young couple might just be a little bit too expensive.
So are these potentially then people, and please, Siobhan, jump in at any time as well, people who are sort of probably struggling already to get into the housing market and had stretched themselves to the absolute limit to start with?
Look, purchasing property is actually a really emotional decision. And what you'll find is, you know, young couples will walk around properties and they'll look at the houses maybe within their budget, and then they'll see something at the extremes of their budget or just outside their budget, and they'll fall in love and say, I've got to have it. A good colleague of mine, a mortgage broker, says that they come to him all the time and they say, look, just find a way we we can buy it. And, of course, the major lenders, you know, shy away from a loan that's, you know, right at the nth degree. However, when it comes to second-tier lenders and third-tier lenders, they normally find a way to allow them to buy it. So they end up being able to buy the property that maybe they couldn't afford in the first place.
And that's the problem, right?
That is the problem.
Look, I'd say that's part of the problem, to be sure. People do go in making a very emotional decision for their first property. They do envision it as their forever home for their family.
Which it really is, right?
It really is, yeah. But that is why there is that obligation on lenders not to allow them to be into an unsuitable loan.
Look, I think the you're right. The lenders obviously have to be cautious with their lending practices. But I think people have to be cautious of their borrowing practice as well. They need to say, what do we really need? What can we really afford? And what happens if something goes wrong? You know, the challenge that we all face in life, I suppose, is there's so much income comes in, but there's so many things attracting us to want to buy. You know, you turn on your phone nowadays in the shopping centre and you start getting text messages from the retailers promoting specials and things they've got. You know, you've got apps on your phone that show advertising come up, you know, even driving up the freeway to get to here. You know, there's big billboards up there, you know, just tempting us with advertising, you know, buy, buy, buy. We need to sort of put aside and save for the rainy day.
People being too aspirational then?
Yeah. Look, I think people like to, you know, obviously keep up with you know, what's the trend at the moment and so on. And whilst the boom time's good and money's good, that's fine, as long as you're putting some aside for the rainy day.
We also have to realise that the wealth and the level of living that people see around them, it is normalised. They don't think that they're reaching. They don't think that they're being imprudent. They just think they're normal.
Yeah.
Where does that come from?
Look, I think, you know, the old saying about...
That's frightening. Yeah. That frightens me.
Well, it is. I think if you talk to the older generation, they'll tell you the stories about growing up in the three-bedroom, one bathroom with a sleep out and, you know, struggling away and things like that. However, you know, the generation, and especially around Baldivis and the lower sort of priced areas like that, you know, the Byfords, the Armidales, the Gosnells and Ellenbrooks and so on, is that... you know, they've grown up, unfortunately, they've grown up in a scenario seeing, you know, a disposable society where we buy things today and we throw them away if they break. We don't get them fixed anymore and, you know, we chop and change and we buy, you know, new things all the time. So it's a disposable society and I think that, you know, means money's coming in and coming out the door just as quick.
A couple of texts coming in. John says, Economics 101 says that supply and demand set prices. Nobody seems to be considering that the large population of baby boomers is in the process of retiring and not having enough super. We'll be selling the McMansions. The supply will be larger than demand from the following smaller population cohorts. Regardless of the state of the economy, house prices will be forced down. That's from John.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, supply and demand is exactly it. There's an oversupply in places like Baldivis, so, of course, that puts pressure on prices to go downwards. Unfortunately, what's dragging the prices down even further is the fact that you've got some forced sales, some desperate sales. Probably one of the best things that could happen, you know, in a suburb like that where it has an oversupply is the people that are on the market that are overpriced, that are hoping for a wish price, you know, if we get our price, we'll sell type attitude, they're probably better to be off the market because they're really clogging up the market. If the market was actually had less property available, hence the supply and demand equation that the gentleman's mentioned there, what you would find is the property prices would stabilise and possibly even work their way back upwards again. So whilst there's that extra oversupply of stock of property, it's actually holding it down.
I'll just check, Paul. Are you suggesting that some people who are on the market are because they choose to, not because they have to?
Absolutely. I think in all marketplaces there is the handful that desperately need to sell. There's the ones that, you know, want to sell, and then there's the ones that, if they get the right price, they'll sell.
I think my perspective might be a bit skewed because I see only the ones who desperately need to sell and can't.
Absolutely. They're the ones that will be coming to you for sure, yeah.
Do we feel we need to own a house?
Absolutely.
The people that come to you.
Look, that's housing security. That's building into your future. That's leaving to your children. I mean, that is just part of your basic hierarchy of needs to have secure shelter, and that can't be met by a rental.
Michael, good morning.
Good morning. I think one of the problems at the moment is that there is a general lack of education and understanding in the consumer market about how housing markets work. And often there's a fairly uncritical attitude to how banks lend to consumers. and also sales pitches that real estate agents, not all real estate agents, but some of them, can give to people looking to enter the market. Most people, I work in the industry and I have access to a lot of information, a lot of data, and it's actually the area I work in, so I'm familiar with it. And I don't expect the general population to have that information, but there is information out there in areas like, you know, you have to look at trend analysis in things like Price Finder data or CoreLogic or any number of sources that can tell you what's actually happened, what has happened over time, what's happening in terms of supply, what you can reasonably expect. And if households are borrowing to the hilt in a time of record low interest rates and they're already stretched, then you don't have to be a brain surgeon to work out that you're actually going to come under stress when things start to change. So I'm just a bit concerned that the general level of knowledge and awareness in the market is not particularly high.
And is that the responsibility of the agent, Michael?
That's a very good question. A good agent, an ethical agent, I think, should have some responsibility to communicate to people what's been happening, what could happen in the market over the medium to longer term. Mm-hmm. But not all agents do that.
Michael, I totally agree with what you're saying there. And you know, good agents obviously should educate their clients and the investor clients as well. That you know, it's an interesting scenario because you know, purchasing a property is an emotional decision, and a lot of couples, you know, they fall in love with a property and they just want to have it no matter what. And a real estate agent can say, "Hey guys, you know, it's a little bit expensive for what you're really looking for," and so on. And you know, I dare say that you know they will go to their broker and aim to get the money. But you're right, I think there is a lack of education out there, and especially with buyers buying and expecting that they're going to make money on a property in a short period of time. You know, we all know that, well, the ones that have been around for a while know that market cycles work in cycles, and you know, to really make money out of property, you've got to hold on for 20 or 30 years to see some cycles that might be bad, like we've come out of for the last 10 years, into the good cycles that are yet to come. And we're seeing some green shoots at the moment of prosperity. So those green shoots are on their way, and the market's going to start moving.
Areas, though,
absolutely,
yeah.
In all areas, yeah. So, you know, I agree, education is vital.
Yes, there are green shoots. I agree with that. But it's also very much location specific. So you need to actually obviously understand, buyers need to understand what is driving demand for real estate, particularly in outer-lying suburbs. What's driving the demand for property? What is going to influence population growth? What's going to influence where people live in a certain place, transport networks, access to employment, a whole range of other factors that most people don't necessarily think about or have access to. But it's not enough to say, as a generalisation, that the market is, yes, it is, it's on the improve. Yes, it probably is at bottom or showing signs of recovery, but that's not going to be a boom response like we saw in that peak period around 2012 and shortly after. So it's going to be a slow, sustained recovery, I think. But most people, most general consumers don't actually understand that or appreciate the dynamics of it.
Michael, appreciate that. Thank you. And Michael, for our listeners' benefit, is actually an analyst in property economics, so he obviously does work in this area.
I think he's absolutely right in terms of education. So, look, financial literacy is very low. We tend to think of financial literacy a little bit differently than we do normal literacy. I get people coming to see me and they are very, very capable people. They're intelligent, they're skilled, they've had fantastic jobs. I've had CEOs in my door. In terms of being familiar with, you know, sensible long-term fiscal planning, in terms of what happens when accidents happen, in terms of where are my insurances that I didn't know I had that I can claim, things like that. That's what people are lacking, and that's what they're not taught in schools. And I think it's not even reasonable to expect agents or banks to be the voice of reason here, to be the one telling them this is what you should know, because they do have a conflict of interest.
So unaware of those ongoing costs, many of them, and also maybe a little naive about how quickly an investment property or your property will increase in price. I mean, it's not something you can flip in 3 or 4 years. I know that does happen, but it's generally not the norm.
Exactly. It's not the norm. And, you know, it's essential that, you know, when people go out to make a purchase of $350,000 or more, that they do their research. They do have an understanding of what happens in the marketplace. And it is really a long-term investment. It's not something you just buy and hopefully sell tomorrow. You really have to hang on to it for the long period of time. And I agree that Siobhan's, you know, advice there of, you know, having that financial education. And I think there's a degree of responsibility as well. I mean, you know, I don't think you can blame the real estate agent or blame the banks. I think you have to say, well, I'm going out to make a purchase. It's going to cost me $350,000.
That's my
decision. What do I need to do to make sure I understand exactly what I'm investing my money into?
And I'm taking that risk.
Yeah.
Yeah. At the same time, I think there's a term for it, though, is the unsophisticated borrower. So, for example, you know, you've got quite a lot of skills and intelligence and knowledge behind you.
That's a lovely compliment.
And look, and a lot of other people, again, they will be very skilled and knowledgeable, but perhaps not specifically about this, and especially when they're going in not for an investment property but for their own home, they are doing it with their, you know, hearts full of hope and their dreams big in their eyes. They are at their most vulnerable, at the least likely to be making these kind of cold clinical plans, and that's when there needs to be either a safety net or something to stop them from getting into something which could so very easily be upset, especially when they are borrowing at their max and not at the lower levels.
We'll talk after 10:30, because we will continue this conversation through to 11 about how you can get out of these difficult financial situations. But first I want to go to Bill. Good morning, Bill.
Yeah, I just want to ask a couple of questions. They mentioned $350,000. Well, I bought in Heathwood years ago when I got divorced. It was about $76,000. Now it's about another $300,000. Basically, I see everything as greatly overpriced. It's all right for my son in Woodvale doing accountancy and law, because he puts value in his house and he doesn't do any work, just gets everything invested and built up, and it's worth a lot. But what I see as a problem is we're the only country that allows people to come here, and he has a lot of friends who come from Asia and everything, China, to buy properties which are inflating the prices. And where the government says this is all right, they're serving themselves, because they get a lot of extra money and rates and everything, but they're not serving their constituents. I mean, we're the only country where you can buy property. You can't even buy it in New Zealand unless you're a resident, which then puts pressure on those people to actually put something into society, not just come here and buy to invest and make money. And the other one is, I see a real contradiction when we have people like my son or others, wealthy people, politicians, can buy 2 or 3 houses and then claim a tax loss through my son doing accountancy in negative gearing. Basically, housing has become an investment, not for ordinary people. When you say, I listen to what the panel says about how wise people should be, but you can be all the wise in the world. When you've got to borrow great sums of money and you're having people pouring money into this country who don't live here, and other people are investing to basically buy and at a loss, in other words, dodge their taxes, I don't see a lot of hope.
Bill, thank you. Impact on foreign buyers?
Yeah, look, Bill, I disagree with what you're saying there. I think that, you know, couples that go out and get a second property as an investment property is actually helping the society. What actually happens with investors is they might scrimp and save to actually have a investment that's there to help them further themselves and maybe have something in retirement. And, you know, they might be giving up the cigarettes, the extra drinks and the extra partying and cutting back on their own expenses to have a rental property to allow for somebody to move in and rent that can't afford to buy in a house. So I understand what you're saying. However, I think that, you know, there's the tax benefits there for the benefit of the government, in actual fact, so they don't have to provide housing for those people that are renting the house.
Look, I actually agree more with Bill. I reckon that it is true that we do have properties across the country that are sitting empty because they're either investments and they can't get rentals, or because they're owned by foreign nationals. Now, look, a bit beyond me in terms of whether all that's good or bad or appropriate, but the fact of the matter is that having something which is geared towards investors does make it harder for own home buyers, and it is true that prices do rise when demand is high.
That might be the case, but as you can see in Baldarbus, the demand's not high.
In the studio this morning is Paul Baird-Murray. He's a real estate agent in Baldarbus, and Siobhan Meerman, a financial counsellor. And they're here to take your calls, give you some advice as well if you want. We are talking about mortgage stress. I'm going to get to some calls in a moment, but a couple of texts that have come through. Phil says, in 1988, my mortgage interest rate went as high as 18% from an initial rate of 12%, even that being too high. Now, that was serious stress. The banks have no conscience or social responsibility. I detest them. I have not owned my own home since. I'm now retired and living in community housing and happier with no financial stress, living within my means, which is the key. And that's Phil in Subiaco. Okay, Phil, thank you. Mick. Illness, job loss and improper lending practices are major contributing factors. We bought in Waikiki in late 2015, despite the fact that I was on long-term sick leave. I had to resign due to illness. Relationship broke down early 2017 and I've been homeless and destitute. My house cannot be sold, mortgage a lot more than its value, and I go to sleep each night hoping I'll quietly pass away in my sleep.
We do hear, sadly, a lot of stories like that. It is devastating, like you can't even imagine what it feels like for them, and you're hearing it every day. Especially, as I say, you get ill, it may not be severe enough to access insurances that, again, people don't always know that they have. You may access it, but it doesn't pay out for long enough because you can't sell your house. You do fear about the debt that's left over. You do have relationship breakdown because, I mean, money matters. And at the end of it, it can leave you in a very, very low place.
Let's take some calls. Let's go to John. Good morning. Hello, John. No, that's Donna. Hi, Donna.
How are you? I can't think of your name.
It's Nadia. How are you, Donna?
I'm Nadia. Beg your pardon. Nadia, the people that you've got there as guests, they've brought up some really great ideas. Sometimes in the paper I see where the forces like the Air Force, the Army and the Navy are looking for groups of houses to long-term rent for their employees.
Sell to them. Yes,
they don't want to buy them; they want to rent them. But they give them back to you at the end of the lease, and they, you know, paint them and titivate them up. And I was just wondering if you've got all these houses lying dormant down in Baldarbus, why wouldn't somebody do that? Contact the government and say they've got a group of houses for long term rent.
Well, let's ask the agent. Thanks, Donna.
Hey, Donna, that's a great question. And the Defence Housing do own a lot of properties through Baldarbus and Rockingham. There's no question about that. They do have a special criteria for each house, and that criteria has to be met, and some of those properties may need modifications to fit the criteria. But, you know, they do that, and I think it comes back to the government spending, where they require the housing at the time, and certainly Rockingham, Baldarbus is a popular spot for the Navy, and the Defence Housing do spend money in that area at different times to purchase properties, and we've had the privilege of helping them find properties that might be suitable.
Thank you very much for that, Donna. Let's go to John. Good morning, John.
Good morning. I've recently been to Vancouver, and what they're doing over with empty properties over there is taxing the people that own them. They have a high Asian population from China that have done exactly what they do here, and they're taxing them, so they're forcing them to rent them, which is helping ease the crisis.
Yeah, thank you very much for that, John. And a similar idea was floated, I think, in Fremantle, wasn't it, where they were looking at, the council was looking to see if there was any way they could add some sort of a levy or a fee or something on vacant blocks to force rentals. Let's go to, but we don't want to go off topic. We want to stick to this issue of mortgage stress today as well. So 1-300-222-720 is the number if you have a question or a story to share. Mike, hello.
Yep, hi. Just a quickie. When I bought my first house, you could not get a bank loan unless you had 30% deposit. So, of course, you know, nowadays, as we've heard some of those terrible stories, they've borrowed up to almost 100% or, you know, even if it's 80% or whatever. And then when things go wrong, of course, they're in big trouble. When I got my loan at 30%, you still had to have other money to make sure that if you were sick or unwell, that you could cover it. So, you know, I think the encouragement for everyone to go out, rush out and buy a home is a great idea, but realistically, a lot of people probably, well, also bought way above their capabilities. I mean, my first home was a very ordinary home, which most people used to do, and then try and get a better home later or be satisfied with far less. So there's issues with availability of money in that period far too easily and far too percentage, and also people wanting, you know, four bedrooms, two bathrooms, you know, 65-inch TV, etc. Mm. So, you know, really it's about affordability anyway, and if you can't afford it even when you're not working, then you really shouldn't be buying it, unfortunately.
Mike, thank you very much. He raises a good point. And does there need to be some changes there?
Look, I do think that affordability is always a factor. However, again, from what I'm seeing in my job, people are getting into properties that they could afford. They had good jobs, they had the deposits, and yes, sometimes they have borrowed 95% of the value of their property. They've paid for mandatory lender's mortgage insurance, which is not always great. And look, some of them aren't planning for if they get sick or ill, but also I have people coming in my door saying, look, I had savings. I paid for my mortgage from my savings for a year. I thought I'd be back in work by now. I'm not. What do I do?
Yeah, those speed bumps come along the way in life, I dare say. And, you know, obviously divorce is one of the worst ones because that can cripple you financially. You know, loss of job and job changes and those types of situations are a real concern. However, that last caller, you know, he was really talking about having rainy day money, having enough in the bank if something goes wrong. And, of course, you know, as you mentioned, Siobhan, you know, people, you know, they might not get back into work as quick as they anticipated. And, of course, that starts eating into the savings and maybe, you know, getting into a situation where they're really behind the eight ball. And, you know, the four-bedroom, two-bathroom trend that we have is really maybe overcapitalizing. I mean, the crazy thing about it is when you think back to when you first met your loved one and you wanted to, you know, get together, you wanted every moment of the time with each other and you wanted to spend every waking hour with that person. And if you stopped and thought about it and you just lived in a smaller house and you had two incomes coming in, let's say, or even one when you have children, you'd maybe have more time available. I was talking to a young couple just yesterday. And the husbands had to go out to work 6 days a week to try and keep a mortgage going on a $460,000 property. And they're finding it hard. And, of course, you know, they have a young child that wasn't expected at the time, and that's come along, and that's lovely. But at the same time, it's put financial stress on them. And, you know, it's a real challenge, you know, when those things happen. But having that such a large mortgage because of the feeling of having to have such a big house is really crippling a lot of people. Just not fair.
Paul, you know, good points. So I'd probably ask you a couple of questions. I mean, one would be, what's the availability of smaller houses? Because at least I know what's mostly advertised are the family homes because they're what's make the money.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, what lender has given, what is it? Was it a dual loan? Was it just for him? And if he has to work 6 days a week, if it was always like that, it probably shouldn't have been given to him and he should come see a financial counsellor.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, that's the great question because this young couple, they have a $460,000 house and they're thinking about selling and getting down to a $350,000 house. So they can reduce their mortgage straight away, get back to working 5 days a week. However, when you start delving into the situation with a lot of people is do they spend on other things and are they wasting money? And this particular couple spend $1,200 per month on cigarettes.
Wow.
Half their mortgage repayment is spent on cigarettes.
They're not going to get a lot of sympathy from people.
They won't get a lot of sympathy from people, and they know that, I dare say. But you know, I think it comes back to our spending habits and actually being, you know, that financial literacy we spoke about before of actually thinking about, you know, how do we educate the population? How do we educate people to make them aware that, you know, life will be so much better by just having some disciplines in place and have some budgeting?
Yeah, we are this. We want to need things instantly and credit. Everyone has a credit card. I don't think I got a credit card till I was 28 because I wasn't allowed one before that. But Jared in Wanneroo says, before you sign the loan documents, take the monthly repayments and multiply by the time of the loan. Make sure you are seated when you press the equal button. Jared, thank you. And this one, Nadi, when my husband and I bought our first house, a 3x1 in 1992, we made sure we could afford the repayments if interest went up to 17% and if we were on one wage. We also saved 20% for the deposit. With that, we saved money also by having older cars and cheaper holidays. We could also afford to pay more off the loan. We paid it off 7 years later at the time our first child turned one, and we are now mortgage free. Did it again, bought a 4x1 and now mortgage free. And this one, do we need to teach kids at an early age the value of a dollar and learning to live within your means? And there are quite a few people texting through making that very point. If you can't afford it, don't buy it and be realistic about what you can afford. Danny, good morning.
Morning. Thanks for taking the call.
Pleasure.
I was advised that if you have debt, you have nothing but debt. And I came to Australia, got a loan. That was I was fortunate enough to be in 2007 when it was on the cusp of crashing. I bought the house, it crashed, and 6 years later I've paid it off. And I'm just a normal guy doing a normal job. But the thing that has always stuck with me was the case there is that if you've got debt, you've nothing but debt. It belonged to the bank. Now, the person who gave me the loan, he said the first thing that you got to do is you use the credit card that they give you to everything. You do everything on the credit card. And simply because for the credit card, it gives you 40 days of where you can use the money. And it says if you use that, you will always come out. If you use it and you clear it every month when the money is due, you will always be in front. And with that generous advice that I was given, that's what I've done, and it's helped me. Thank you for the gentleman who gave me that advice.
Thank you very much, Danny, and good on you for listening to good advice. On the text, Keith says, I don't think it's the house cost, it's the greedy property developer charging $300,000 for 400 square metres of land. Keith, it can be even less than 400 square metres. And this one, I'm loving the input from all the baby boomers saying you bought beyond your means. Well, the reality is that the property market is so different to when they were first buying. I would like to know how long it takes to save 20 to 30% on a property worth $500,000 and how long the boomers saved by comparison. The market is very different. Maybe you could shed some light on that one, Paul.
Look, the market is different, and I think a lot of young couples nowadays are, we see the trend of people living at home longer with their families to save up for those deposits. And it does take a long time, or I suppose it all comes back to how much income they're earning, how disciplined they are. I think the key factor here that we need to keep in mind is discipline of, you know, how you earn, how much you can spend, and what size property you should buy.
Yeah,
buy within your means.
Is definitely good, but we got to recognise that you can't always control that part of your life. I mean, we've got people who they can't stay home with their parents rent-free to save up. We've got people who did that, got their loan, but then something happened. And that's the problem, because when something happens, it all falls apart anyway.
And it is granted. The illness, yeah. Loss of a job, those things that we've talked about. Okay. Let's go to Steve first, because he segues nicely into what I want to talk about next. Steve, hello.
Yeah, good morning, guys. I would like to say there's a hell of a lot of money out there in this country, and it's all held up in superannuation, and I'd like to be able to access that to pay my own off, because there's not much point in accessing it when I'm dead.
Is there merit in that, Steve? Thank you.
Look, superannuation is a very dangerous topic. It can sometimes be exactly what you need, but it is also very easy to access and blow that money for no benefit whatsoever, particularly in the long term. Anyone who is thinking about accessing their superannuation, please duck in and see a financial counsellor, because it is something that we would want to look at in a bit more detail.
Okay, so when somebody comes to you and they are in this situation of mortgage stress, they're at risk of already got the default notice from the bank, how do you get them out of it?
Look, it depends. I mean, it depends upon the reason that they're in default. For example, if they've lost their job and they're looking for time to get another job, then often we can try to make arrangements so that they can get the time they need, or at least their best crack at getting another job. We can look at reducing the repayments or stopping the payments temporarily. We would never touch...
And all banks will agree to that in certain circumstances?
Yeah, look, so there's a financial hardship obligations that all creditors must adhere to, so long as it's reasonable and it's considered to be a short to medium term, not a long-term situation.
And if they can't sell a house? So obviously they get to a situation where they're getting well below the purchase price of their house. The mortgage is more than what the house is worth. What do they do?
Well, sometimes they can't do anything. Some of the banks won't actually release the mortgage. So let's suppose they bought it for $400,000 and they're trying to sell it for $320,000. The bank may look at the mortgage and say, well, we won't release it. You can't sell it. So they are in a pickle when that happens.
So what's the way out
then? The best way out, well, one of the ways out is to contact your bank early. Talk to them. Tell them you're in strife and see if they can give you some assistance.
So don't wait for the first default notice.
Don't wait. No, not at all. You have to get onto it straight away. When you see yourself going down that sort of situation, down that street, you need to get onto the phone of the bank and talk to them and explain where you're at and what you do and what they can do to help you. And the banks normally will help you in some way, whether, you know, it might be... The reasoning might be because they've lost a job and they need to get back on track, and when they get that job again, it'll be okay. So they might put them on interest only. They may actually hold the payments, their mortgage repayments, for a period of time. Of course, they've got to pay that back at some point, but just to give them a bit of breathing space.
Yeah, look, and I'll just interject quickly. Yeah. Sorry. Just to clarify, look, it's not the bank helping you. They are actually obliged to provide this assistance.
And is it worthwhile having a financial counsellor with you to help you through this process?
Look, always. It is increasingly hard to get us because there's not many of us and we're a bit underfunded. But please, if you can, come in and talk to us, if only so you can get prepared with your rights, with how to go about it, with how to frame the argument and with what you're even asking for. Mm-hmm. Don't just accept what the banks offer you, because they don't know your situation. They'll just give you a prescribed resolution.
And then you also have to look at other expenses too, obviously.
Absolutely. Look,
so you look at all of that.
Prioritisation. People often prioritise their debts in not the wrong order, but perhaps some things can be left to lie and others can't.
Like what? What's the order?
Well, I don't want to say anything that might give people the wrong idea. Everything is different. But for example, people have lost their home before because they're more worried about the synergy bill. You know, So there are means and ways and strategies, and sometimes even just coming in, even if you're very capable, come in, have a chat, work up a strategy, know your plan of attack over the next 12 months, and then when you go back out and you're getting into it, you know, you'll just be on a bit firmer footing.
Looking into the future, so I was doing a bit of reading, and if interest rates go up by 1%, what's the impact on those struggling? I've seen a figure of as many as 1 million Australians would then be suffering mortgage stress.
Most of the people that I see, again, and my perspective might be a little bit skewed by the people that I see, but most of those who I see, they are already mortgaged to their hilt when they first got the loan at the percentages at right now, often, again, only having like a 5 to 10% deposit, often with a dual income, full-time work. So they're already at that point. If the interest rate goes up, we are just going to see staggering wave after wave of more people losing their home.
And what about the market then? Where are we at there? Because that's worrying.
Well, it is. The market will certainly move, and it's going to move in a positive direction. Because
all real estate agents say that.
Well, no, the market says that. If we look back on history, markets go up and they go down. When they go up, they usually go up too far. And when they go down, they normally go down too far. So, you know, when you stop and think about, you know, history tells us a lot. And we know that the cycles are normally 7 to 10 years. We've come out of a pretty challenging 10 years.
And there are people who are 9 years having bought a house, and the house is, like we heard earlier,
it's worth less.
$70,000 less.
Yeah, exactly. So we've come out of a very challenging time, but a challenging time that we probably won't see these same things occur in our lifetime again. So, you know, one would expect that we will have ups and downs again. There's guaranteed for that. All markets do that. And we will see the market rise back up again. Look, population's got a lot to do with it. Obviously, the population increase we had with the mining sector was on the move. You know, that brought a lot of people to Perth, and it brought a lot of people to buy property, and it put a lot of pressure on property, which pushed the prices up. And probably one of the challenges that we also face in most marketplaces is that people usually buy when things are booming, and they need to sell when things are in the lull. And that's the opposite. You should be doing the opposite. You should be buying when it's in the lull, if possible, and only selling in the boom. But that comes back to your time horizon again. And if you have a long enough length of time and you're planning on living there for a number of years rather than chopping and changing, and you're going to be there for 20 years or more, you're probably going to see the growth in the property. But to rely on the last 10 years and say, well, property's not worth it, well, it's a wrong decision to make, because property is worth it, because if you hang on to it for long enough, it will always recover.
You have to be realistic
if you can hang on to it.
If you can.
If you can, absolutely. And when we talk about if you can, what we also find is that Siobhan, you'd see this, is that by making a few adjustments in their lifestyle, they may have enough in actual fact to keep the house.
Look, some rare glorious clients could choose to reduce their discretionary spending. I wish it was more, but look, most of the ones that I see don't have any wiggle room. They're coming to me and they have already cut back everything they can.
Yeah. Yeah, don't leave it too late too is the message today. Thank you very much to Siobhan Meerman, financial counsellor, and also real estate agent Paul Baird-Murray. Appreciate your time this morning.
Thanks,
Matt. Thank you.
And if you do need help, financialcounsellingnetwork.org.au is a organisation that you can jump online, check them out. They've got locations all across the metro area, and it is free advice as well, which is really important. So please get help if you need it.